will be studying a book written by His Holiness, it's only appropriate that we try and have the same motivation that he does. So one that's very extensive, wanting to be of the greatest benefit to all living beings, and one that is willing to work hard on the path in order to gain the qualities necessary to do that. So let's have a mind of joyous effort that's willing to engage the path so that we can cultivate the wisdom, compassion, and skillful means or power necessary to be of the greatest benefit, just as His Holiness has that motivation and practices in that way. Okay, so we're starting a new book this evening, Approaching the Buddhist Path by His Holiness and me. And part of me is thinking, oh, this should be a momentous occasion, and I should feel very emotional about it. And it is a momentous occasion, but I don't feel very emotional. Because this was many, many years in the making. And it's momentous in the sense that the book's finally done. after a couple of decades. But, there's still more to go in terms of practicing the path. So we're not done yet, not at a place where you can take a vacation yet. So I thought to start reading read and then stop and make comments as I read. And I thought to start with the preface, because that tells a little bit of the history of how this book and all the other books in this series that's called The Library of Wisdom and Compassion, how all of these books came about. And so I start off with the story here, and kind of each volume in the preface I add a little bit more, but the main story is here. Okay, so this is we have a prologue, don't we? And then we have a prologue, and then we have a preface. So the prologue is from His Holiness, ghostwritten. But all of his books are ghostwritten. You know, he doesn't have the time to sit. And he doesn't write in English, I don't think. So, they're always his ideas, and then people, put pen to paper or fingertips to keyboard. Okay, so His Holiness says, "The world we live in is very different from the world at the Buddhist time. Yet we human beings have the same afflictions and still experience physical and mental suffering. While the truth of the Buddha's teachings transcends historical eras, the way they are presented to practitioners in a given time is influenced by the specific culture, environment, and economic and political challenges. I encourage us to become 21st century Buddhists, people whose view is rooted in the Buddha's message of compassion and wisdom, and who also have a broad understanding of many fields, such as science, especially neurology, psychology, and physics, and other religions." Okay, so His Holiness has been talking a lot now about becoming 21st century Buddhists. Yeah, and how we straddle adhering to the tradition, because the Dharma is not something that we can change. The way the human mind works, what samsara is, how it comes about, what nirvana is, how we bring that about. that doesn't change, you know, because it's all dealing with the same kind of human mind. So we don't want to change the path and the teachings. And yet the presentation, yeah, has to accord with the historical period, as well as the country and culture. Yeah. And so, you know, when you look at His Holiness's life, you know, the early years were spent in a very different culture. I mean, in old Tibet, they didn't use wheels. They didn't have the wheel. When you sit and think about that, okay? And a very, you know, economically, you know, you had the landowners and then you had the peasants or the serfs, whatever you want to call them. And so very different kind of society. And now, here he is, and he never expected it when he was a child, you know, being in all these other countries, talking to neuroscientists and physicists and engaging all sorts of people who, you know, in his early years, he didn't even know what they looked like, you know. There was Heinrich Herrer and his friend, you know, so two white people who snuck into Tibet, you know, and a few Chinese, yeah. And then later on there, you know, there was Mongolian. I don't know if any Russians ever came, but the Mongolians were talking to the Russians because Tibet was stuck right in the middle between the British interests in Central Asia, the Russian interests, and the Chinese interests. But none of those people really, you know, not so many foreigners came to Tibet. They weren't allowed to, yeah. And now look at who His Holiness is talking to. Yeah, and look at the world that he lives in. And look at the situation of Tibetan Buddhism in this world. Yeah, it's very, very different. And so His Holiness is really trying to bridge that gap and be able to talk to everybody. Yeah, and especially with the Tibetans, to maintain the old culture, maintain the Dharma, but get them the whole culture so it can relate to the 21st century. And similarly, not that the West is in the 21st century, because when he talks about becoming 21st century Buddhists, he's talking to us as well, okay? Really, I think, indicating that we're supposed, that he wants us to bring Buddhist values into the world that we live in right now. And not just, you know, there's our Dharma life and then here's the rest of our life. Or here's what they do at Buddhist centers and here's the rest of the culture that we live in. Yeah, but to really try and integrate things and have a modern mind. Yeah. So what does that entail? You know, what is a 21st century Buddhist? So he gave us a clue here in terms of knowing about science and different scientific disciplines so that we're able to dialogue with people in those fields. Yeah. And he also mentioned other religions. So to know something about other religions and to have an open mind and a skillful way of talking so that we can talk about spiritual beliefs with respect to people that we may disagree with. Yeah. So in ancient times, in ancient India, they debated all the time, and that was really cool. Everybody was cool about chopping each other's beliefs into bits. And the idea was whoever won the debate, then the losers would convert and become disciples of the one who won the debate. But right now, you know, that's not too skillful to do. Yeah, because the other religions that we're dialoguing with, you know, they don't want to do debate. Yeah, and also the way their religions are structured, lots of times it's just on belief and there's not a whole lot, you know, to debate, and the debating could be actually harmful to those people in the sense that it's not like if they lose the debate, they're going to become Buddhist, But if they lose the debate, they will lose faith in their own religion, and they will stop trying to be ethical people. And that doesn't help anybody. Okay? So he wants us to dialogue, and with people who want to debate about different beliefs, and who can handle that because they're really intellectually curious, then yes, debate and discuss with them. But with other people, to try and point out the traits that we have in common with their different, with their religions, so as to create a feeling of harmony in this world of members of different religions. Because so often through history, people have killed each other in the name of religion. Yeah, so we don't want any more of that. That was actually what got me totally disillusioned with things. I majored in history in college, and every generation in Europe, people are killing each other in the name of God, and I just decided, well, if that's what religion has you do, then I don't need it, because I don't advocate killing people, especially in the name of religion. Yeah. His Holiness stresses again and again how, because people are different, philosophical or theological ideas may make sense to them, but as long as they have good ethics, and they talk about love and compassion and so on, and try and be good human beings and not harm others, then we should encourage them in whatever spiritual practice they do, and not try and make them lose faith, by debating them such that then they, lose their reason for keeping good ethical conduct to start with. Yeah. So he when he talks about theistic religions, he says, well, with a theology there, then people believe they are created in God's image. And so if they're created in God's image, then they should try and act godly in some way. And they should respect all of God's creations, especially other people. And so when he talks to Christians, he really encourages them. Yes, respect all other living beings. Don't harm them, because this is your religion, and, what you do according to your beliefs. And we do the same. Our philosophy may be different, but the practice is coming to the same point. And so let's all join together and do that. Yeah. And he also is very strong, and he'll talk more about other religions soon, but very strong on the idea that people, all the leaders of different religions should really come together and speak in one voice about problems in the world. And similarly, Buddhists should join with scientists speaking about the problems in the world, such as climate change and so forth. Okay, so to really open ourselves up to the rest of the world. We're not in Tibet, surrounded by high mountains, getting all the foreigners out so they don't disturb us. We're in the middle of the world, trying to contribute to the benefit of the world. Okay. Our Buddhist knowledge must be expansive, not limited to just one topic, practice, or Buddhist tradition. Now, some of his Tibetan disciples are going to go, what? You don't want me to be limited to one Buddhist tradition? But my tradition is the right tradition. It's the best one. Look at our lineage, So yes, he's trying to stretch everybody's mind. We should try to learn about the teachings and practices of other Buddhist traditions and understand how they suit the particular dispositions and interests of the people who practice them. Okay? So, he's saying, don't just stick to your own tradition, say your lineage, have patriotism to your own lineage, and not try and understand how other people think and why other presentations of the Dharma may be better for certain people because of the way they think, you know, because of their disposition. And so let's not, you know, be sectarian. Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, there's sectarianism in the West, and it came from our Tibetan teachers, who all say, don't be sectarian, but when you, you know, the behavior, you know, is, well, we have our teachings and our lineage, and here's the, our lineage is the best one, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's a funny kind of thing how, you know, we're told, you know, don't be sectarian, but the role models we see have that happen. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that we should go around and taste all 31 flavors, you know, go from one Dharma center to the other, one type of Buddhism to the other, one teacher to the other, saying, well, I'm not being sectarian, I'm going to try all of them out. Yeah, because if you do that, you're going to, I mean, what happens if you go to the ice cream store and you take a half, you know, one teaspoon of all 31 flavors? Yeah. Do you ever get anywhere besides a stomach ache at the end? You know, so it's not this thing of, you know, going shopping and being a consumer and I've got to try everything. It's, you know, you have, you know, your basic practice that you do, and if you encounter a teacher that really speaks to your heart, then it's usually that teacher, and the practice that they teach usually speaks to your heart, and then you stick with that. But on the basis of having one primary thing, after you gain some familiarity with your primary tradition, then to learn about other traditions can be very helpful because they will emphasize different points that maybe aren't emphasized in your primary tradition or unpack different points that you're used to or say the same points but in a different language. And that can really help you with your own practice. Okay, so we're not going window shopping here. And Lama Yeshe used to call it making soup. You know, when you make soup, okay, we put in some broccoli and some cauliflower and some tomatoes and some beans and some noodles and some chard and some this and a little bit of this, and then you put it all in one pot and cook it. You know, he says, no, you don't want to make soup. That's not what we're trying to do. Yeah. But you bring, when you're stable in your practice, you bring in things from other traditions that enhance your own practice. Okay? So I can say, for example, from doing this project with His Holiness, where he said he wants this series to be different and not just be a repetition of the Lam Rim teachings, but he wants the viewpoints of other Buddhist traditions included in the book. And so that part was assigned to me to do. So I was reading the Pali Canon. I went to Thailand. I have connections with Chinese Buddhists and learning their practice and so on. And I found that all of this just, it was marvelous in terms of enhancing my own practice. Yeah, and it was really wonderful. I mean, I listened to, Bhikkhu Bodhi has a whole series on the Majjhima Nikaya, over like 150 videos or something, no, audio. I listened to all of them from beginning to end, and it was so good. I mean, because our tradition, the Lam Rim, the practice in common with the initial level being and with the middle level being, this is all in the Pali Canon. So, you know, But it was explained sometimes a little bit differently, and with the stories of the Buddha's life and how he went and discussed with all these people. And so it really helped my practice. Yeah. And similarly, learning some of the presentations of bodhicitta from the Chinese tradition, very, very helpful. Remember, I shared the translation from the Chinese of one of Vasubandhu's 10 things on bodhicitta. So inspiring. Okay, so you know, this way you kind of build on what you learn, and then you also learn about other traditions, and I think you also learn how other people think. And because not everybody thinks like us. I mean, in one way, it's very true. The more we understand our own mind, the more we understand how other people's minds work. So that's true. And it's also true that other people think differently than we do. Yeah. And so if we're going to become Buddhas, we have to learn how to understand other people's way of thinking, so that we can present the Dharma to them in a way that is going to meet their needs and their aspirations. Yeah, because if we don't, if we just say, okay, well, I have my way of presenting the Dharma and there's only this way, then that's like having a buffet dinner and you only put on it the food you like, without any consideration of other people's health or their tastes, you know, what they can eat and what they can't eat. Okay? So just as in, you know, a buffet, you know, you have dairy and you have non-dairy, and you have gluten-free and you have gluten, and you have sugar and you have sugarless, because everybody's different. So too, in the way that we present Buddhism, yeah. There's differences according to that. And so it really helps us to meet people from other traditions. This is one of the values. The Western Sangha, the Western monastics, for 22, 23 years now, almost every year, we meet together in the autumn, the monastics, and just share together about our practice and our traditions as friends. It's not a conference. We don't publish papers afterwards. We don't make declarations. We just meet together as friends. And it's really beautiful, the kind of exchange that we have, and learning about each other's tradition. And then really seeing how different teachings suit people with different dispositions. Okay, I'll give you one example. There's one young man who's practiced for many years in the Theravada tradition, and he came up to the abbey. He wanted to talk to me and ask some questions, and you know, and we had some really good discussions. But I was, I forget what question he was asking, but I was saying, you know, well, this, you know, this group of people present the answer this way, and this group presents it this way. You know, because we have the different tenet systems, philosophical tenet systems and so on, and different vehicles. And so I was explaining different ways that different groups answered his question. And he just said to me, can you just tell me the one right answer? Yeah? And I thought, oh, you know, look, here's one person who comes to Buddhism, and they don't want to know the variety of views. They want to know the one thing that is right, in other words, right for them. Okay? They don't have a mind that wants to learn all these different things. Just tell me what I need to know, and I'll practice that. You know, and then you meet other people, and they want to, you know all the different, what everybody, Dharmakirti and Chandrakirti and Shantideva and Buddhapalita and what all of them said, and then they'll think about it, okay? So different, real people really different in that way, you know? And similarly, some people, they really want to practice and attain nirvana and be done with samsara, and they don't have much interest in bodhicitta or full awakening, although they love the Buddha. And then there's other people that hear about bodhicitta and they say, wow, that's for me, I want to do that. So there's, you know, people are very, very different, yeah? And so to have a big mind that can respect other people instead of having old stereotypes about them, yeah? Because it's, when you look, you know, this is kind of around just within the last, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 years, Buddhists from different countries and traditions have started meeting each other. Because before, there wasn't the transportation, there wasn't the telecommunication. People didn't know each other's language. They, you know, if you read about the traveling that the ancient masters did and, you know, how many people died going from, you know, China to India or from Afghanistan to Tibet or wherever. Yeah, and you can see, well, you know, they didn't know much about each other. And so they had lots of old stereotypes that were passed down from one generation to the next. Yeah, and now is the time when we really have to overcome those stereotypes and get to know each other and respect all the different traditions and different approaches and really abolish these stereotypes because they're really dreadful. Okay, and all the traditions have them. Yeah, I mean, when I went to teach Singapore Buddhism in Singapore, yeah, it was 1987. Okay, so there was maybe one or maybe two other Buddhist Tibetan Buddhist groups at that time. Now there's tons of them, but when I came, you know, there was one Sakya group that I remember, and I don't even know if there was any more. If there were, they were very small. Yeah? And so the Singapore is mostly Chinese, and the Chinese image of Tibetan Buddhists is they do magic, basically, what it boils down to. They do magic. Yeah? So I was walking in the park one day and one man stopped and asked me for his lucky number so he could win the lottery. And I had to say, I'm sorry, I can't tell you. And he really insisted. Yeah. And then other people, you know, didn't want to come to the teachings because they thought, well, the Tibetans, you know, they do tantra, so they're all having sex and drinking alcohol. Yeah. I encountered this when I was in Hong Kong. One man wanted to offer sangha dana, you know, lunch. And we went to a restaurant. And then he started asking me if I did tantra and tantric sex. And I said, it's time that I go back home now, you know, because this was the stereotype that they had. You know, but then, of course, the Tibetans think that the Chinese all do blank-minded meditation, you know, because all they remember is the debate at Samye in the 8th, 9th century. Yeah. And the Tibetans think the Theravadas are selfish, you know, because they don't want to attain, they don't want to generate bodhicitta. And the Theravadas think that both the Chinese and the Tibetans are following the Mahayana, which are scriptures that were made up. They aren't even the Buddhist teachings. You know? So you have these kind of misunderstandings that are just, you know, you can see where they come from. You know, they come from not knowing people, but hearing a little bit and misunderstanding it. Yeah. And so if we're going to be 21st century Buddhists, then this has got to go, really. And, you know, we've got to make sure from our side we have a correct understanding of other Buddhist teachings and respect them properly, you know, and also present our own tradition accurately so that people don't get wrong ideas about what it is. Okay? So some of the things that you read about in the newspaper recently about some Tibetan Buddhist behavior, it's not helping this issue at all. You know, it's people reinforcing the wrong image of Tibetan Buddhism, for example. Okay, so this is all when His Holiness is talking about 21st century Buddhism. This is all included in it. Okay. We may also include some of the teachings of these other traditions, Buddhist traditions, in our own practice. In this way, we will better appreciate the Buddha's skill as a teacher. Yeah, and that's one thing that I really got out of studying the Theravada and Chinese traditions is like, wow, the Buddha is so skillful and can present the Dharma in so many different ways according to different people's mentality. You know, I thought, so amazingly skillful. So we will better appreciate the Buddha's skill as a teacher, which will reduce the sectarianism that limits us Buddhists from acting together to contribute to the welfare of all people and environments on our planet. And so that's what he wants us to do, contribute to the welfare of all the people and their environments. Yeah. But not just be socially active and like that. We should also understand the full path to awakening and how different teachings can be practiced by the same individual at different points of his or her spiritual journey. This will clarify our personal practice as well as increase our respect for all Buddhist traditions and other religions. You know, so one person on their spiritual journey, what they practice may differ at different times. Okay? And that's how the Lam Rim is laid out. And that's how we can also, let's say, come to respect people who believe in a creator, even though in our teachings we refute a divine creator right, left, and center. You know, the idea of a permanent God is just completely torn to bits in Buddhist philosophy. But we can see that for some people in their spiritual journey, that belief is really very, very good for them. Yeah, and so we encourage that in them. Yeah, and we respect them for it. And then we know that as time goes on, yeah, their minds will change and their minds may become open to other kinds of ideas, at which point they may be more interested in certain Buddhist things. But even if they're practicing a theistic religion, there's certain Buddhist practices that will help them tremendously. You know, meditating on the Four Immeasurables, develop shamatha, you know, serenity, concentration, many different things that they can learn from from Buddhism that helps them in their own tradition. And then that also plants seeds. And then, you know, future lives, then, you know, we've made that connection and people may turn to the Dharma. Because that may be the way that we actually found the Buddha's teaching in this life was because in the previous life we practiced some other tradition that helped us create good karma and virtue, and through that, then, you know, we're able to meet the Buddha's teachings in this life. Yeah? To grow these understandings in ourselves, reciting prayers and mantras is not sufficient. While perhaps increasing our devotion, these activities alone do not bring wisdom. So they're good, but reciting prayers and mantras alone isn't going to get your realizations. In the modern world, we need to be realistic and practical, and for this, knowledge is essential. All of us want happiness, not suffering. Since both happiness and suffering arise in dependence on causes and conditions, we must know the causes of each so that we can train our minds to create the causes for happiness and abandon the causes for suffering. So His Holiness always comes back, dependent arising. Learn the causes that produce the results that you want to have. Learn what the causes are for the results you don't want to have so that you can avoid those causes. Okay, so always, you know, somebody asked His Holiness once, if Buddhism had a slogan, what would it be? And he said, dependent arising. Yeah? So that's it. All of us want a harmonious society. Since society consists of individuals, to bring about peace, each individual must cultivate peace in his or her own heart and mind. Of course, the ultimate aim of the Buddha's teachings goes beyond world peace to liberation from all rebirth and cyclic existence, or samsara. But the teachings can help us to create a more peaceful society while we are still in cyclic existence. Okay? So, he wants us to help society now, but that's not sufficient. We have to progress on the path to liberation and awakening, okay? So he's saying, you know, we need to keep our Dharma view and have our long-term motivation and also work to contribute to the benefit of living beings now. The material in this series accords with the general presentation of the Indian sages of the Nalanda tradition, who are held in esteem by all four Buddhist traditions in Tibet, as well as Buddhist traditions in China. Yeah. So Nagarjuna, Vasubandhu, you know, many of the Nalanda masters are included in the lineages in many of the Chinese Buddhist traditions. Most of the quoted passages come from these Indian sources. And in terms of the method aspect of the path, renunciation, bodhicitta, and the perfections of generosity, ethical conduct, fortitude, joyous effort, and meditative stability, there is little difference among them. Okay, them being all these different Buddhist traditions. Tibetan traditions follow Nagarjuna and speak of the non-contradictory nature of emptiness and dependent arising as the essence of the wisdom aspect of the path. Here, we will emphasize Tsongkhapa's presentation of emptiness and sometimes mention teachings from the Nyingma, Kagyu, and Sakya traditions. Because the Pali tradition emphasizes the fundamental vehicle, which is common to all Buddhist traditions, we also cite passages from it. Okay, so here, kind of saying what sources of all these Buddhist traditions are we drawing upon? Okay. In general, my teaching style does not follow the approach of the traditional lamrim, or stages of the path teachings. I like to speak a lot about emptiness and show its relationship to other aspects of the path. This way of presenting the teachings also flourished in ancient India. Many years ago, His Eminence Geshe Lundrik Namgyal, the Ganden Tripa at that time, said to his friends, "Understanding His Holiness the Dalai Lama's teachings is challenging because his way of presenting the material is special. He touches on this point and that, but we are unable to integrate everything into the traditional framework." Yeah, but we are unable to integrate everything into the traditional framework of the teachings. I wonder if this is praise or criticism. Mm-hmm. So maybe it is unable to integrate, and the inability to integrate is our problem. In any case, please think deeply about the various topics in the manner explained, Contemplate how these topics relate to one another and to your life. Okay, so that's His Holiness's prologue. Okay, then the preface that I wrote. Everything comes about due to causes and conditions, and this series is no exception. Explaining some of its causes and conditions will help you understand the purpose of this series. Its ultimate purpose is to lead you, the reader, and other sentient beings to full awakening. Although many excellent works on the stages of the path, the Lam Rim, already exist, there is a need for this unique series. To explain why, I will share a little of my personal story, which is typical of the first generation of Westerners encountering Tibetan Buddhism. So born in the United States, I grew up in a Judeo-Christian culture. I tried to believe in God, but that worldview didn't work for me. There were too many unanswered questions. When I was 24, I attended a three-week Dharma course taught by two Tibetan lamas, Lama Thubten Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche. One of the first things they said was, "You don't have to believe anything we say. You are intelligent people. Examine these teachings using reasoning. Practice them and see through your own experience if they work. Then decide if you want to adopt them." This attitude of adipasika, this is the Sanskrit pronunciation, okay, or come and see. Let's stick with the English. The attitude of come and see, okay? That the Buddha spoke about in the sutras attracted me. Studying, contemplating, and practicing the Buddha's teachings over time, I became convinced that this path made sense and would help me if I practiced it sincerely. Like many young Westerners in the 1970s, I steeped myself in studying and practicing Tibetan Buddhism as best I could, considering that I didn't know the Tibetan language or much about Tibetan culture. Our Dharma education commenced with the Lam Rim, a genre of texts that lead readers through the progressive stages of the path to awakening. Here it is helpful to look at the place of Tibetan Lam Rim works within this tradition. After the Buddha's awakening, he taught across India for 45 years. Sensitive to the needs, interests, and dispositions of the various audiences, he gave teachings that were appropriate for them at the moment. So this is the Buddha's skill. He teaches to that audience what they need at that time. Okay. After his passing, or parinirvana, the great Indian sages organized the material in the sutras by topic points and wrote treatises and commentaries explaining these. After the Dharma spread to Tibet, Tibetan masters also wrote treatises and commentaries, of which the Lam Rim literature is one type. Okay. So Tibetans see this development of treatises, commentaries, and commentaries on commentaries, and commentaries on commentaries on commentaries, as a demonstration of the sages' kindness. The fortunate ones who were direct disciples of the Buddha had great merit and could attain realizations of the path without needing lengthy teachings. Yeah, because they had a lot of merit. They were ripe fruit. You know, since those of future generations had less merit, their minds were not as sharp, and they required more detailed explanations to dispel their doubts, generate the correct view, and attain realizations. Since people's minds are even more obscured and they have less merit now, new commentaries are needed. Our teachers thus said, "The sutras are like freshly picked cotton, the Indian treatises and commentaries like woven cloth, and the Lam Rim texts like ready-made clothes." Okay. When the first generation of Westerners were introduced to the Lam Rim, we were told that everything we needed to know was in these texts, and all we had to do to gain awakening was to study and practice them correctly over time. However, yes, but things didn't turn out to be that simple. From the very beginning of the Lamrim, we had doubts about topics that for our Tibetan teachers were obvious. Okay, Precious Human Life, one of the initial meditations of the Lamrim, speaks of our fortune being born as human beings, not as hell beings, hungry ghosts, or animals. Tibetans, raised in a culture that believes in rebirth and various realms of existence, accept this without question. However, for those of us raised in Christian, Jewish, or secular cultures that respect science, this is not the case. Okay, we heard these things and we're going, huh? Furthermore, while our Tibetan teachers talked about all phenomena being empty of true existence, we were wondering, does God exist? You know, that was our question. You know, emptiness, what's that? I want to know, does God exist or not? When they taught selflessness, we were trying to find our souls or our true selves. When they explained dependent arising, we were seeking the one absolute truth, independent from all else. Philosophically, our views did not coincide. Okay? So that's why, I mean, I suppose at some of the very first teachings, they weren't ever recorded because hardly anybody had tape recorders then. But I think after a while, some of them started to be recorded. And I'm sure if we listened, you know, the questions were, you know, kind of, you know, we're asking, does God exist? And they're going, what's God? And then the translator said Ishvara, because Ishvara is a Hindu god, you know, or Brahma. But our idea of God isn't Ishvara or Brahma, okay? But that's the closest, yeah, could come to. And of course, we were all, you know, trying to find out who we were. And Buddhism is teaching us who we weren't. Yeah, you know, they're saying selfless. There is no I, and we're saying, I want to find out who I am. Okay, so it's really, when you think about it, it was really quite amazing, you know, that you had these people from very opposite ends of the planet geographically and culturally attracted to each other. Yeah? And you had the most conservative aspects of Asian culture and the most liberal aspects of Western culture coming together. I mean, it's really crazy when you think about it. Yeah. And the kind of hippie generation walking in, long hair, the guys with straggly beards, you know, the women with blouses that plunge down to here in front of the monks. And, you know, and then our first question is, Lama, would you like some marijuana? Yeah. It's really good. You can meditate when you're stoned. You know, try it. And Lama's going, no, thank you. Okay. And, you know, I mean, my generation, so hedonistic, you know, talk about the eight worldly concerns. Our thing was, if it feels good, do it. Remember that? That was our slogan. If it feels good, do it. Forget everything else, you know. So, you know, and so then it's us coming in contact with these celibate renunciate monks. Yeah. It's really far out when you think about it. The traditional presentation of the teachings assumed that the audience had faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha and was free from doubts about religious institutions and issues around authority. Oh boy. Okay. So the traditional presentation assumed that the audience had faith in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. We're coming along going, who's Buddha? What's Dharma? What's Sangha? You know, can you tell us in English what these things are? You know, and why should we have faith? We were taught to have faith in the religions we grew up in, and they couldn't answer our questions. So why should we have faith in another religion? And our religious institutions were all full of, you know, people who acted one way during the week and another way on Sunday morning. And, you know, we don't trust religious institutions very much. They're kind of corrupt. They're kind of power hungry. You study history, and they're all accumulating a lot of money and then oppressing the people and telling the people to give them more money because they create more, they're closer to God if they give the church more money. And for us, that's just corruption. Yeah. And now we're coming here, and are we seeing all of this again? You know, plus, we don't really trust authority very much. We grew up during the Vietnam War, and when the government was lying to us. The government was telling us all sorts of truths. So things haven't changed that much till now. But, you know, why should we believe any authorities? They lie. They're sending the young people over to Asia to get mowed down in a useless war that none of us want. Why should we trust authority? Yeah. So this is the kind of attitude we're coming in with. Yeah. To people steeped in hierarchy and respect for authority. You know? And we're coming into that. It's crazy, isn't it? It's totally crazy. Okay. The teachings were directed towards people who could separate their emotional needs from their spiritual practice and who would correctly understand the teachings. Okay. But for us, we can't separate our emotional needs from our spiritual practice. You know, we came in and we have, you know, we don't get along with our parents, we reject authority, you know, we need love. Yeah. And they're teaching for people who knew, okay, here's your spiritual practice, this is the way you practice, but don't expect your teachers and the institution to meet all your emotional needs. And we're coming in with, but I have so many emotional needs and I need to be heard. Yeah. And they're going, you need to be heard. Actually, you need to listen. Okay. For example, they assume that we would not be overwhelmed with guilt when reflecting on our harmful actions. Wrong. Okay. We came from a culture that where we were taught to feel guilty. And the more you hated yourself for your sins, the more you were atoning for your sins. Yeah. They had no idea when they were teaching certain things that this is the ears we were hearing them with. Yeah. And, oh, one thing. Tsong Rinpoche, when he first went to Italy, Italy's real, you know, it's a Catholic country. So this was way early. It was, I don't know, late 70s maybe, something. Yeah, must have been, or mid 70s. He went to Italy, and I heard what he taught there for a week was about the lower realms. Yeah, because in his way of thinking, you know, when you have these uneducated Tibetans who were herding the yaks and so on, if they heard about the lower realms, they would wake up and they would, you know, listen to the teachings on karma, and they would start to restrain themselves from negative actions and practice virtue because they didn't want to be reborn in the lower realms. But people who grew up in a Catholic country, when they start hearing about the hell realms, what happens? Fear, panic, guilt. Yeah. Rinpoche, he didn't know that this was the ears that the audience was hearing through. Yeah. And it's amazing that many of the people stayed there at the teachings. There was some power, some connection there that many of the people stayed. Of course, many of them afterwards were going, what the world is he talking about, you know? And then you had people who were saying, if I believe in Buddhism, then I'm going to go to Christian hell for being a heretic. But if I believe in Christianity, then I'm going to go to Buddhist hell for having wrong views. Yeah. So it's like, this is what was going on, you know. So they assumed we would not be overwhelmed with guilt when reflecting on our harmful actions. What were we? Overwhelmed by guilt. They assumed we would not harshly criticize ourselves when contemplating the disadvantages of self-centeredness. No, we did harshly criticize ourselves when contemplating the disadvantages of self-centeredness because Western culture teaches you that you're bad if you're selfish. Doesn't it? We all grow up, don't be selfish. That's bad. So you hear about the disadvantages of self-centeredness and you say, I'm so selfish. You know, I'm such a bad person. Look at me. And the Tibetan lamas had no idea this is what we were hearing when they taught the Dharma. You know, it's completely the wrong conclusion. They assumed we would not succumb to our culture's tendency to idolize the charismatic. Wrong again. Okay. They assumed that, you know, we would know what are the qualities of a fully qualified Mahayana and Vajrayana teacher and that we would check those qualities before forming a relationship with the teacher. We never heard what's Mahayana, what's Vajrayana, you know, what are the qualities of these teachers? We didn't know what any of them were. They weren't translated. Yeah, the texts weren't translated. All we knew is like we met these teachers and they're pretty far out. And, you know, somehow there's something about them that we're really attracted to. But then people couldn't tell what was it they were attracted to. Yeah. Was it the philosophy? Was it the practice? Was it the fact that they were very, very kind and compassionate? Was it, you know, the fact that it was mystical and these were people from Shangri-La who had been cloistered in the Tibetan mountains for centuries where they were yogis meditating single-pointedly in caves, not eating, having visions of extraordinary things, and we want to be like them, and they're going to teach us how. You know? Because we grew up in a culture where, you know, you idolize sports heroes, you idolize movie stars. Yeah. So here we're going to idolize these far out exotic Tibetan lamas. You know, if they're from a different culture with a different language and they ring bells and sound drums and they have holy water. And they sit in meditation, immovable. And they also look at us, me, with that special gaze of compassion. They look at me, and they're so far out, yeah? And this is the way we related to them, yeah? And, you know, you can see this. I mean, this is, we were all like that. Now things are slightly better, but you can see this is still a problem with people. You know, we're all aware of the controversy, the scandal going on in the Shambhala community right now. And I was reading some of the things that have been put out about it. And there was one woman who was talking about going to some of the parties with the Sakyong before he got married, and how all the women were flirting with him because they all were hoping that to be his wife. You know, because if you could be the wife of the leader of the whole Dharma organization, wow, you know, then you really had the key in to learn the most exotic teachings. And then also you must be somehow special above everybody else to be the one that he chose. Yeah. And so, you know, people were in that kind of mental state and then willing to go along with different things. And, you know, their discriminating wisdom, they didn't know how to use it. Nobody had ever taught them. They were just going on, you know, what's charismatic and what's shiny. Yeah. And that's what we all do, don't we? You know, because we don't know any better when we first meet the teachings. So, you know, all of this was big, you know, very problematic. I happen to be extremely lucky and meet really, really good teachers, you know. But because I look and I was totally naive, you know, when I met the Dharma, I totally naive. And I could see how very easily somebody could, you know, just fall in love with the charisma, you know, and go down all sorts of crazy paths. Yeah. From our side, we Westerners assume that all Tibetan teachers were Buddhists. Yeah, without a doubt, they were all Buddhas. They didn't have any worldly anything at all. All Buddhas. Okay, that's not realistic. Okay, so we thought they were all Buddhas and that the values we grew up holding, democracy, gender equality, care for the environment, and so on, we thought they would be perfectly embodied in Tibetan society. And then you live in Dharamsala, and in the early days, you know, we saved our plastic bags and tins and things, and there weren't any wrappers. But then as time went on and India modernized, there you see in the middle of the Buddhist capital in exile, where you think that they're going to have all your progressive Western values, and they're throwing their plastic all over the side of the mountain. And the toilets don't work even. And there's many places you don't even have toilets. Yeah. And they can't cooperate together to make a water system so that coming down from the mountain, you have maybe 20, 30 individual pipes rather than one pipe that goes to the village and then branches out. You know, so we came with our expectations. They came with their expectations. Yeah. I mean, I remember being at Kopan the first year I was there, and there had been problems with villagers, you know, coming into the monastery and stealing things, even though Kopan was incredibly poor. I mean, really poor at that time. And so one day I saw one of my teachers putting glass on the top of the wall that surrounded the monastery. And I'm going, oh, he's putting glass on top of the wall of the monastery. Those people are going to get hurt climbing it. I thought we were Buddhists and we were generous to everybody. Why are we trying to protect the things in the monastery? If people want these things, we should just give it to them. Isn't that what Buddhist teachings say? And I was totally scandalized. Yeah? And then one time I saw a Western monk who was ordained the year before I was reading Time magazine. Oh my God, how can he read Time magazine? You know, that filth. You're a monk. You're supposed to be pure. Yeah? So, you know, you come in with all these expectations of, yeah, this is Shangri-La, you know, without a doubt. So all these assumptions on both sides were incorrect. And after a while, many Westerners began to have difficulties with their Dharma studies and practices. The cultural difference was difficult for us and for our spiritual mentors, who were doing their best to teach people whose perspective on life was totally new to them. It took many years for all of us to realize that Westerners require pre-Lam Rim teachings. Yeah, so our teachers didn't realize that. We didn't realize it. You know, that before you could start the traditional Lam Rim, you needed to have a whole lot of other knowledge. Okay, but we didn't know that at the beginning. For us to grow in the Dharma, the stages of the path need to commence with material that meets our dispositions. Yeah. Somebody told me when they read the preface that they were going, oh yeah, I understand exactly what she's talking about. One of my old Dharma friends said that. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama understood this and adjusted his teachings in the West accordingly. Instead of beginning with a reliance upon the spiritual mentor elevated to the status of a Buddha, he started with the two truths, how things appear to exist and how they actually exist. Rather than tell us that reciting a certain mantra a few times would protect us from rebirth in the hells, he explained the four truths of the Aryas, those who non-conceptually perceive ultimate reality. Instead of saying that drinking blessed water would purify eons of destructive karma, he taught us about the nature of mind, the workings of the mental afflictions, and the possibility of attaining liberation. So His Holiness was really very special, you know, because many of the lamas approached us as they would approach Tibetans, you know, blessed water, saying mantras, you know, rely on a spiritual mentor who's a Buddha, these kinds of things. And His Holiness quickly realized that, you know, in the West he had to teach in a really different way. And he did. Diving into the philosophy that underlies the Buddhist worldview, he asked us to think deeply about it. He challenged us to doubt our anger and to open our hearts with compassion for all sentient beings. His was a no-nonsense approach. And when he learned that, contrary to Buddhist scriptures, the earth was not flat and revolved around the sun, he was quick to say that if science conclusively proves something, we should accept it and not adhere to scriptural pronouncements to the contrary. Okay? So I remember one of my precious teachers, Kensar Jumpa Tekcho, fantastic teacher. I studied with him for many years. He grew up, you know, in old Tibet and was taught through Vasubandhu, that the world was flat, and he believed that. And when we lived in France, one of the nuns, a Swedish nun, brought in a globe and tried to explain that the world was round. He wouldn't hear it. And then he said, you know, because they talk about below the surface of the earth, so many pakses, this is their measurement of different things, so many pakses below Bodh Gaya, then you come to the hell realms. So she figured out the measurements of pakse and how many it was, and it came out that below Bodh Gaya, that many pakses, you wound up in California. You know? And tried to say, Geshe-la, you know, according to Vasubandhu, the hell realm should be here, but, you know, I know people who live there. And, you know, so it, you know, was very difficult with some of the traditional Geshe's. And even now, all these decades later, when His Holiness teaches, he always talks about how the world is round and how, as good Buddhists, You know, we can believe the world is round. It's not, we're not committing, you know, blasphemy or anything, and that we must accept what science can prove. Yeah, he's so practical. In this environment, in 1993, I requested an interview with His Holiness. The interview did not happen for another 2 years due to His Holiness's full schedule. During the interview, I humbly requested him to write a short Lamrim text designed for non-Tibetans, a text that Tibetan Geshe's could use to teach Westerners. It would present the topics in an order suitable for people who did not grow up Buddhist and would deal with doubts and issues that non-Tibetans had about the Dharma. His Holiness agreed with the idea, but he immediately stipulated that a larger commentary should be written first and then points extracted from it to make a root text. He asked me to speak to senior Dharma students about the topics to include, gave me a transcript of a Lamrim teaching he had recently given to use as a foundation, and asked me to begin. I spoke with many senior Western practitioners and assembled a list of questions, topics, issues, and doubts that they would like His Holiness to address. Over the ensuing years, I met with His Holiness several times to address these topics and to show him the work I had done so far on the manuscript. In our time together, he taught specific subjects upon my request, offered deeper explanations of others, and answered the many questions that I had accumulated. He seemed to thoroughly enjoy these sessions and usually invited other Geshe's and his brother to come. I would ask a question, and they discussed the answer animatedly in Tibetan, with His Holiness asking the Geshe's what they thought, bringing up points they had not considered. Mm-hmm. After some time, the translator gave me the conclusion of the discussion. So I kind of felt like Shariputra in the Heart Sutra. You know, I asked a simple question, a short question, and then they would take it and discuss this and that and go all over. And I'm going, what are they saying? You know, because it was all in Tibetan. As I continued to add more material from many of His Holiness's oral teachings and from our interviews, the manuscript became larger and larger. I came to see that the purpose of this series was to fill the gap between the short Lamrim texts and the teachings lamas gave in the West and the long philosophical treatises translated into English by scholars. Western practitioners needed a concise presentation in their own language of the major topics in the philosophical texts that could also be the basis for an analytical meditation on the Lamrim. Okay, so that's what I began to understand in this. In 2000, yeah, because there's lots of Lamrim books, you know, one volume Lamrim books written, you know, from a Geshe's oral teachings at a Dharma center. And then you have these translations of the Indian and Tibetan texts, where one sentence is a paragraph long and the vocabulary has so many big words that you've never heard of before put together in a way that you've never heard before, that you have no idea of what in the world they're talking about. And so I began to see we needed something in between these two, something that was more advanced than the one-volume Lamrim presentations and yet not as complex as the translations of the commentaries. We needed something with the material in it, but in a very clear way in English that people could understand. And also, His Holiness, I think I mentioned this, I hope, His Holiness always tells us that we should that we shouldn't just study the Lamrim, but we should learn the Indian classics, the treatises and the commentaries by the Indian sages, and that we should meditate on them. you know, not just think that those texts were for study and for meditation. You use the very short little pithy books. Yeah, so he really wanted a lot of the, you know, the philosophical studies integrated in this book. So in 2003, I began to read the manuscript aloud for His Holiness so that he could check it. We soon realized that this would be a lengthy process that his schedule did not permit. I remember when His Holiness says, you know, bring the manuscript and we'll go through it together. And I told his secretary, you know, about this. And his secretary just went, His Holiness doesn't have the time to do that, you know. And so quickly, actually, His Holiness said that too. So in 2004, he asked his translator, Geshe Dorje Damdul, to go through the manuscript with me. Geshe La and I worked methodically until 2010 doing this. His Holiness also clarified that this series was not meant solely for Westerners, but all those who have interest in Buddhism, particularly the Nalanda tradition, and are keen to study and practice, but need a new approach to it. Here he included Tibetans born in the Tibetan diaspora who have a modern education, as well as Asians from Taiwan, Korea, Vietnam, and so forth, who were attending his teachings in Dharamsala, India, with increasing frequency and interest. Okay, I'll just read to the next thing. This series chiefly contains the teachings of the Nalanda traditions, the classical Indian Buddhist traditions stemming from the great monastic universities such as Nalanda, Adantapuri, and Vikramasila. This is the Buddhist tradition the Tibetans and to some extent East Asians inherited from classical India. However, His Holiness clearly stated that this series must be unique. It must not be limited to the Nalanda tradition, but must also include information about and teachings from other Buddhist traditions. It was time, he said, that followers of Tibetan Buddhism learn more about diverse Buddhist traditions and their teachings. As he began to speak more and more in public talks about being a 21st century Buddhist, I came to understand his wish to dispel wrong conceptions and stereotypes that practitioners of various Buddhist traditions had about one another and to bring them closer. For this purpose, he asked me to visit other Asian countries to learn about how they practice the Dharma. I stayed at a monastery in Thailand and also visited Taiwan to learn from scholars and practitioners there. I continued intra-Buddhist dialogues with Buddhist monastics in the West at our annual Western Buddhist monastic gatherings and became familiar with the teachings of their Asian teachings. Teachers. These were very rich, rich experiences. In the 2011 series of interviews, His Holiness clarified that to fulfill the above purpose, he wanted a book explaining the similarities and differences between the Pali and Sanskrit traditions. While most books that introduce the many forms of Buddhism deal with more superficial topics, such as altar layouts, forms of worship, and so forth, this book was to deal with doctrine. Okay, so not, yeah, all Buddhist traditions are the same, they all make bows, but, you know, people in this country bow this way, and people in this country bow this way, and the other country. He didn't want that kind of stuff, yeah. He wanted people to think deeply about the Buddha's teachings and his skill in addressing the various dispositions and interests of his disciples, the Buddha's skill. By this time, the manuscript was too large to be a single volume. To fulfill His Holiness's wishes, I extracted and abbreviated portions of it to form Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions, published by Wisdom Publications in 2014. The present series, The Library of Wisdom and Compassion, which will be published in several volumes, explains the path to Buddhahood as set forth in the Nalanda tradition, as practiced in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. In some sections, it brings in teachings from other Buddhist traditions to enrich our understanding and give us a broader view of a topic. The series also incorporates several other purposes. It links study to daily life and formal meditation practice, which is very important. We should practice what we study. It serves as a bridge for both new and seasoned practitioners from the short Lamrim text to the lengthy philosophical treatises, which I just spoke about. And it exposes the reader to the tenets and practices of other Buddhist traditions. Because some of the topics have already been explained in Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions, we will sometimes refer you to that book.
Did you ever get any clarification on the glass?
On the what?
On the glass that was on top of the walls.
Oh, I figured out. I mean, he was having to protect the monastery from having its things stolen and to protect the villagers from creating the negative karma of stealing. Yeah, because to steal from monasteries creates very negative karma.
You said that the Tibetan teachers give us the example of being sectarian, or gave us the example of being sectarian. I also heard the version that we also, as Westerners, put our own view into that, that we come from a Christian background, and so there are different schools, like Catholicism and such.
Yeah, of course. Of course, we brought our own stuff. And, you know, the Tibetans weren't saying, look, we're going to be sectarian, this and this, you know. It was just this, how it was, you know. You practiced according to the monastery that was in your valley, and you learned that tradition. And you didn't know much about the other traditions because they were in another valley. Yeah. And certainly Westerners are not immune to, you know, our tradition is the best one. So I think, you know, really think about here, His Holiness's vision, what he wants us to know and how he wants us to practice. You know, really think about that. What does it mean to become a 21st century Buddhist? Yeah? And I think that might be, you know, a topic of some, you know, a discussion group that you have. Really sharing thoughts, you know, because here we are, especially at the Abbey, we're starting, you know, the Sangha here in the West. What does it mean to be a 21st century Buddhist in the West? Yeah, so I think good if we think about that, and that's what His Holiness is guiding us to do.
I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about having listened to all those teachings by Bhikkhu Bodhi and how that influenced your practice.
Oh, okay. So how studying the Theravada influenced my practice. I really loved reading the Pali Canon and hearing, and His Holiness had said this in an interview too, you really get the feeling of the Buddha as a person, as a human being. And also when you read, you see how he talks to different people in different ways. Yeah? And how he speaks to some people, you know, very gently, how he debates with other people, how he scolds a third group. You know, just incredible. You really get a feeling of the skillfulness of a teacher. Okay? Then also, the teachings on renunciation, especially the one about the leper, yeah? That one, that sutra really had a strong effect on me, okay? So, of course, those same teachings are found in the Tibetan and Indian books that we study, but somehow, sometimes they were presented slightly differently, or they were presented in the case, you know, you didn't just learn the teaching, but it was the Buddha was wandering here and he met this person and this was happening and then he explained this. And so you got it more in a context of how it fit. Yeah. Also, what was very interesting to me was I really could come to see how the Mahayana teachings just built upon the Pali tradition, that they are not completely separate teachings at all. You know, it's just the Pali tradition laid it all out, and the Mahayana just built upon it. And it's all there, and it's compatible. And especially reading some of the Pali scriptures, how they talk about emptiness or selflessness. Yeah. And it just, it was like, oh, this sounds like Nagarjuna. And I really began to see, yeah, Nagarjuna wrote in response, because this was what the early schools were talking about, and these were the schools that were active when he lived. Yeah. And so, you know, his first verse in the Karikas about refuting production from self, other, both, and causelessly, you know, I found a couple of sutras in the Pali Canon in which the Buddha was doing that. Yeah? And I'm going, oh, you know? It was just like finding all these little gems.